Hey there, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of A Theology of Hustle, where we talk about work, ministry, and the people who make an art out of bringing them together. Today, we are talking to Josh. He is a psychology professor and actually just a really cool guy to hang out with. This interview is a lot of fun. He is a really cool guy. He has a lot of really interesting thoughts. I think what we really get into with this interview, though, is just the need to really be authentic and really delve into the difficult things, not only of mental health, but also in our theology and the way we interact with God. And there's just a lot of really cool talk about some theology. We get into the humanity of Christ and just some really fun stuff. So one quick note on this episode I should mention is that we talk about a couple of things that may not be appropriate for super young children. Nothing explicit at all, but when I'm in the car listening to podcast, there are certain things I don't want to have to explain to my, 8-year-old and 6-year-old. So there are a couple of those things just to warn you. I figure it never hurts. So I ask that if you haven't already, get out there and review me on Stitcher or iTunes or whatever app you use. That goes a long way towards getting the word out, and just share with friends and neighbors on Facebook or whatever. I really do appreciate all that, and I love hearing from you. So let me know what you think. Let me know how I'm doing, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Josh. Hey, Josh, thanks for joining me from Dallas.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is super fun. It's sad that we can't be in the same room, but, it's good to hear your voice still.
Yeah, so. Good to hear yours as well.
All right. So we like to start off with just talking about your story. So do you mind just kind of giving us the, you can go longer than 4 minutes because you actually have some of the best stories I've ever heard. But why don't you talk to us a little bit about your story and all that?
Yeah, definitely. So, right now I'm a professor of counseling psychology down here at the University of North Texas, which is in Denton. But a little bit of how I got there, I grew up actually close by to you near Chicago in a town called Lake Zurich, which is a suburb about 45 minutes northwest of Chicago. And I grew up. Both my parents were Christians, so kind of grew up going to church regularly. And they also, both my parents were therapists, which was kind of an interesting combination there. And so, went to high school, and I went to, actually first, kind of a little detour, I went to Wheaton College for a year, but didn't really like it and had some difficulties with Wheaton. So then transferred after my freshman year to the University of Illinois in Champaign. Which is about 3 hours south of Chicago. When I first went to college, I didn't really have any clue what I wanted to do. So, but you had to put down something as a major. So I just put down psychology because I was familiar with it. And then, and people say, most people switch majors a bunch of times, but for me, I actually really ended up liking the classes and enjoying the study. So I kind of stuck with it and graduated with a degree in psychology. And you can't really do anything with psychology with just a bachelor's. So I was trying to figure out what I should do next. And I had a little bit of a kind of the only other thing I thought about doing seriously was I was really involved in Campus Crusade when I was in college. So I thought about going on staff with them, but ended up not doing that. And went to graduate school instead, so moved out east to Virginia and got my PhD in counseling psychology at Virginia Commonwealth University. And so it was 4 years in Richmond, and then you have to do an internship, which is like a full-time counseling gig. So I moved down to Miami, Florida, and worked at the University Counseling Center there in Miami for a year, and then got the academic job at UNT. And so that's where I've been for the past 8 years in the psychology department there.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating story. I didn't realize the whole Miami thing. What was Miami like?
It was cool. Have you ever been to Miami?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so it was awesome. I mean, it's like you're, you know, basically on vacation for a whole year. It's beautiful. The beaches are amazing. Lots of good places to eat and go out. It was a little, you know, the year itself, I would say, like, wasn't the easiest year in my life, mostly because I moved there. I didn't really know anyone. And I knew I was only going to be there for a year, too. So I was making friendships and, you know, developing relationships with the knowledge, like, hey, I'm out of here in, you know, 9 months, 10 months. So that was a little difficult. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the easiest place to meet people and get connected either. And I'm not sure if that was partly my issue, kind of knowing I was only going to be there for a year, but it was a little hard to get connected with the community down there.
Sure. That makes sense. Well, so you went directly from that year to getting the job at UNT and moving to Dallas, and that's all she wrote, sort of.
Yeah, that's all she wrote. You know, I knew that's what I wanted to do at that time was be a professor. So I did a national search, probably applied to 20 or 30 places. And yeah, I think I got, it's hard to get a job in academia. So I think I got three interviews and then one job offer. So that's where I went.
Yeah. Yeah. And UNT is a pretty sweet place. I mean, I gotta be honest, like a little jealous. That's awesome.
Yeah. Cause you're a Texas guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I love it. You know, it was a little bit of an adjustment at first. Cause I had never, I think I'd been to Texas once before I went out there and interviewed to visit. So it was totally new for me, but yeah, I like it. I mean, Dallas is really cool. There's a lot going on, a lot of different types of people around, and yeah, Denton's really cool too. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
It's pretty legit. Okay. Well, there's so many places I want to go here. Let's start off with this though. I think when people hear like professor of psychology or whatever, they have sort of a track, or at least I do, where I'm like, he like shows up to school, teaches, goes home, and that's kind of it. But that's like far from what you actually do, right? Can you kind of talk about like all the stuff that you actually do?
Yeah, definitely. I would say my job kind of falls into three main categories. So one is the teaching. So I usually teach one to two classes a semester. And some of that is graduate students. Like right now I'm teaching multicultural counseling for graduate students. And then occasionally I teach graduate as well. So that's one part, but that's probably actually not the main part of my job. Probably the main part of my job is research and writing. So I'm, you know, doing research projects, writing articles, trying to get grants, writing books. And then the third part of my job is supervision of graduate students. So okay. People come into the program and they're working on their PhD. And so when people apply to the program, they apply to a person who is their mentor. So I usually take about one graduate student a year. So I have a group of graduate students working with me, and then I advise them on their thesis and dissertation and independent research projects as well. So those are probably the three main things. And then like service, meetings, stuff like that on the side.
Sure. Yeah. You got to do the administrative sort of side of all that. Right. So be honest, like, I mean, since a student applies to a professor, are you like clamored for? I mean, is it like everybody coming after Josh Hook? You know, I mean,
you know, I wouldn't quite describe it that way yet, but I mean, yeah, I mean, a fair number of students want to, you know, see what I'm doing in terms of my research, and they want to research the same thing. So that's kind of how you apply to programs, is you see people doing research you're interested in, and then you apply to that program and that person. So yeah, you know, if people like the research I'm doing, then they'll apply to the program and want to work with me. So it is kind of fun, you know, because right off the bat, we have some similar interests and are wanting to do work in the same type of area.
Okay. So how does all of like what you do, do you feel like, how do you kind of mesh that with your faith and sort of, you know, the kingdom of God? Where do you see that playing out in what you do?
Yeah, for sure. You know, that was, that's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, one short story, I remember when I was in college trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life. I kind of had this feeling, and I don't know if this was something that I put on myself or something that was taught to me along the way, but I kind of had this feeling like if you were a really good Christian, then you would go into full-time ministry. But then if you were kind of like a second level Christian or like a B Christian, then you could go get a regular job and maybe you you kind of integrated your faith into your job. Maybe you didn't, but it wasn't that awesome. So, and that was part of the reason why I think I had this pull to go on staff with Campus Crusade or go to China and be a missionary, because that felt like the most important thing I could do. And then it was actually really kind of a tension and struggle, because I came to the point where I was just like, I don't really want to do that. I want to go to graduate school in psychology and do that thing. That's what I feel more passionate about. But there was a part of me that didn't feel like that was okay. That was a little bit of a process to get through, but yeah, you know, in terms of how I view my faith integrated with my work, and at UNT, one person who was really influential in my thinking in that way was my advisor in graduate school. So he was a guy named Everett Worthington, and he was a really committed Christian as well. But he worked at a secular institution. And I remember when I was trying to figure out in jobs, like, should I go to a Christian place? Should I go to a secular place? He felt like for himself, he really wanted to be at a place where he could speak into both worlds. Like he could speak into the Christian world and the church world, but also his work could make a difference in the mainstream psychology world. And so that was something I felt was important in my work as well. And, you know, another thing I really have felt recently and over the past several years is I feel like I'm a little bit of a bridge between psychology and church and Christianity and the world of faith, in that, especially when I was in graduate school and early on in my career, I felt like I was kind of in a tug of war between these two different groups. Mainstream psychology historically has been a little bit antagonistic toward Christianity and the church. And then the reverse is also true. You know, sometimes the church hasn't necessarily been the most accepting or friendly towards science and psychology and mental health. And so I see myself a little bit in the middle, trying to have dialogue with both sides. How can I work in mainstream psychology to advocate for faith, for religion, for Christianity, that's an important part of people's lives and something that they bring to the table. And then on the flip side, how can I work with the church and people of faith to recognize that, emotional health, mental health is a really important part of our relationship with God. You can't have spiritual health, kind of broken apart or separate from emotional health. And that those two are integrated and both really important. And I think, you see that in a church, a lot of the things we've seen with leaders having struggles and moral failures and kind of this idea that you really can't have spiritual health unless you are emotionally healthy and you're grounded and you're in community and you're being held accountable and all these different things that I think psychology has a lot to say about. So, yeah.
Yeah, you just hit on like a huge point that I really wanted to get into and sort of ask you about, these sort of culture wars that we have seen, because you do a lot of work with just sort of men and sort of like discipleship and bringing them to a place of wholeness. And so what does that look like using psychology and integrating it with faith? And like, how do those two things sort of combine with each other? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I kind of take a more holistic view to life. So, I think we have different parts of life, obviously. Like we have our emotional kind of world. We have our spiritual lives. We have our physical bodies. We have our relationships. And my sense, I remember talking to a colleague of mine and who works at a church, and he was making the point that he thinks he calls those our boxes. And he said, our boxes are connected. So when something happens in our emotional life, it has a huge impact on our spiritual life, on our relationships, sometimes even on our bodies. And the reverse is true. I remember, just as an example, there's been some research done on attachment, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's like the bond, like the close emotional bonds that we build with the people in our lives. it starts out usually in our relationships with our primary caregivers. And then we also form attachments with romantic partners and our spouses. And then they've also done research showing that we form attachment-like relationships with God. And most of the research has also shown that there's parallels between those. So, for example, if we had maybe a harsh or abusive father or mother, we're likely to view God in that way as well. And versus if we had a loving and supportive parent, we're likely to experience God in that way as well. So that's just one example for how those boxes are connected. But I think, you know, if we try to do any sort of discipleship or think about spiritual growth without kind of thinking about our other relationships, our emotional health, you know, our parents, how we were trauma, all that sort of stuff, I think we're really doing people a disservice, and we may not really see a lot of movement in our relationship with God, discipleship, spiritual growth, unless we're addressing some of those other boxes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, with all this adoption sort of stuff we've been going through, like attachment is like primary, you know, I mean, that's what we talk about with all these kids and stuff. And, but I think you're hitting at something like that I've been noticing a lot in Christianity, which is where there's sort of like this idea that there's this spiritual side of us, right? The spirit, and that's the thing that is like sort of most important. Like, so we tend that spirit, you know, do our quiet time, all that, like read the Bible, whatever. And we're working on the spiritual side of stuff. And that spiritual side of stuff is so disconnected from everything else that we do in Christianity. It's like there's two different worlds almost. And I think that's to the detriment of us a lot of times.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. You know, I think if I could kind of capture what you're saying in a sentence, I think we struggle as Christians with integration. So, and presenting an integrated whole self to the world. You know, we think that, you know, we don't have to talk about, for example, depression, anxiety, abuse, trauma, because that's kind of a separate area, or that's something that someone else can deal with. Or we don't have to talk about our bodies. We don't have to talk about sex. We don't have to talk about food, how we eat. And we get a little weird when we do that. And we don't talk about some of those things or give those things their due. You know, same thing, like people separate you know, religion and spirituality from care for the earth, or, you know, caring for the soil, and we end up ruining the earth. And, you know, a lot of those things, I think, are the root cause of that, is this disintegration or separation between these parts of ourselves.
Yeah, totally. I totally get that. I know you're not an expert on that sort of thing, but what do you think that is in Christianity specifically that sort of makes us do that? Or have you ever thought through anything like that?
Yeah, you know, I think, that's a good question. So I'll offer some thoughts, and then maybe we can, maybe if they head in a direction, they can, you can corral me a little bit. But I think, so sometimes, I think part of that is socialization into a culture, and also, and religion is a type of culture too. So when we grow up, we're socialized into a certain way of being in regard to whatever church or background we come into. So as kids, you know, if you, you know, you have a baby right now. How old is your youngest?
He's 16 months.
When you look at a baby and observe like a toddler running around, they have what one author I really liked. He said that babies and kids have what's called a 360 degree personality. And so when they express whatever emotion or whatever feeling or thought that they have fully. So if they're angry, you know it. They're screaming, they're yelling, they're stomping their feet. If they're sad, they're crying. If they're happy, they're jumping up and down and smiling. And then I think over time, we are socialized into a certain way of being, and we're told that certain parts of us are good and certain parts of us aren't good. So, you know, maybe we are told that, you know, boys don't cry. So we kind of take our sadness and we think that's not good, and we sort of cut that out of ourselves. Or we get mad and we hit someone and we get into trouble. And so we take our anger, oh, maybe that's not a good thing. And we kind of put that away. And little by little, different parts of ourselves start to get cut off. And I think the same is true with, other things as well. Maybe girls are taught that, they shouldn't speak up, or they shouldn't, be loud or have a voice. And so they kind of quiet their strength. Maybe a kid is caught masturbating and they're shamed for that. And they're said, that sexual part of yourself needs to be, that's not okay to be brought out. That needs to be put aside. And so I think little by little, we take parts of ourselves and kind of cut them off, and we become disintegrated. So we put these different parts and we don't show them to the world. We don't show them in our relationships. But I think at some level, they're never really gone. They're just sort of shoved down, kind of like, you take a beach ball and try to shove it underwater. Eventually, it kind of pops up here, it pops up there. So if, and I think that can be a clue to something that's going on that we haven't dealt with. If you have a fit of anger out of nowhere, maybe that's a clue that you have an anger issue that you haven't dealt with, or some part of your anger is put away. Sometimes in our men's work, we call this being put into shadow. Same thing with sex. If you find yourself having, some sort of sexual escapade or crazy urge, that might be a sign that there's a part of your sexuality that you haven't looked at, that you've put into shadow, and that it might be good to be honest about, or look at more critically. So those are a few thoughts.
Yeah, no, that's super fascinating. I'm like, my head's sort of spinning, like trying to even sort of bring that all together. Cause I so get what you're saying. Like, having done some of my work, you see those places where it's just like, that's not really right. Like, what just happened is not how it's supposed to be, right? So like, how do we deal with those things and sort of bring those shadowy places to light, right? I mean,
and then with, one other thing with Christianity too, I think sometimes Christianity has such a, maybe such a high bar, or some churches will have such a high standard for behavior, or, even don't be angry, turn the other cheek. Don't even have a lustful thought. Like, some of these things are almost, almost an impossible bar for people to kind of engage with or live along those lines. And so I think we think as Christians, you can't talk about anger. You can't talk about sex. You can't talk about some of these things. People aren't honest, and they're just portraying a part of themselves to the world and to each other. And the rest of themselves are kind of hidden or put away.
Yeah. And I think to go full circle, that's where you have seen like some major moral failings within like the higher echelons of the church, right? Like, instead of sort of dealing with those things, they suppress them and pretend like they're not there. And then when it comes to, when it all comes to light, then we got some major issues, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then the damage has already been done.
Wow. Okay. That's good stuff. That's really fascinating. We'll have to talk more about that actually next time we're hanging out. I want to jump though to sort of what led you to this sort of work. You had talked about the ministry piece. You had talked about, just feeling like you were supposed to go into psychology. What do you think that was? What was sort of drawing you to that place? And maybe a tag on question to that is, what in the world was it like to be raised by two therapists? I think maybe, maybe those two things are all there,
Yeah. Both good questions. I think, that is a good question. And it's something I've thought of, as I've done my own work and as I've done my own counseling and therapy myself. But I think there is a part of me that's really drawn to the deep kind of interesting parts of human nature and human life, and really trying to understand people and why they do the things they do, why people struggle. And I just find it fascinating. I enjoy talking to people about their past, their history, why they've, why they've become the person that they are today. And so psychology, there's just there's such depth in trying to understand the human person and the human psyche that is really interesting to me. So in a different way than, I think if I were like a business person just trying to sell a product or a lawyer or something, I might get a little bored. That's part of the reason why I'm interested in theology too. And why I read along those lines is because I think, it's really trying to answer questions about people and who we are and why we do the things we do. And, what's the point of all of this? Albeit in a little bit of a different way than psychology tries to answer those questions. So I'm drawn to those questions, those discussions. I think they're difficult. It's hard to have these discussions with people, especially with people who are different from us or from me. Sometimes it brings up conflict, brings up struggle, brings up pain. But it's difficult and it draws me in. In terms of your second question about, what was it like to live with or be raised by two therapists? I think, there were some things I really appreciated about that upbringing. I think, both my parents are pretty psychologically minded, good at talking, listening, discussing, talking about emotions. So I think I grew up with some skills that were helpful for me moving forward in my life, just because I was raised in that environment. I think on the flip side, there were times where it was just, a little too much. Like, my mom would always want to hold family meetings to discuss everything. And so, sometimes I didn't want to share my feelings. I didn't want to talk. I just wanted to be left alone. So I think, that some of that teenage angst, when that was happening, I kind of didn't really appreciate it as much.
For sure. I bet there was a lot of processing going on, right? Always processing something, right?
Yeah, there was. Yeah.
Okay. So, you hit on a really interesting point, that I wanted to come back to, because in a couple of ways, this interview for me was intimidating, because I don't know that I've ever been asked more uncomfortable questions by anybody than by you. I mean, you are like the king of uncomfortable questions, right? And it's never out of, I think there's a legitimate just willingness or curiosity about people that you had talked about. And what is it that like makes you not afraid to sort of delve into those like deeper things and ask those questions?
Yeah, I haven't really gotten that many negative reactions from it. So I think I get, every time I ask someone a deep question or a pointed question, generally it leads to some really good conversation and, understanding the person and their background and where they're coming from in a more in-depth way, and generally a closer relationship with that person. As opposed to just kind of spending a lot of time on the surface. I think sometimes I get bored, just talking about, the weather, like the latest sports teams or, what TV show we're watching lately. Like some of that stuff, I can do that for a while, but then I'm kind of like, what do you think about the Bible? Or what do you think about sex? Or what do you think about, some of these deep issues that are more kind of closer to our heartbeats, I think. What makes you tick? What do you want to do with your life? Some of those questions are more what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, and I really appreciate that, because I do feel like we get so lost with the mundane, right? It's like so comfortable to stay in those conversations you were talking about, that small talk, right? But delving into the sort of questions that you ask, like force relationship on a lot of levels, right?
Yeah, and I think relationship takes time, and it takes shared activities and shared experiences and stuff like that. But you can jumpstart relationship by by being willing to self-disclose at a deep level yourself and seeing if that's reciprocated by others. So you can kind of, I mean, there's people I've hung out with, you know, for a week, and, you know, I felt, you know, like we were brothers, you know, in a deep way, because of how we were able to connect on our struggles and our past. And, but that took kind of asking questions and being willing to share myself as well.
Yeah. Right. A reciprocal relationship, right? Intentionality. It's not just asking questions for questions' sakes, I guess. Right.
Yeah. You have to have a heart of really wanting to know. I think, yeah. And I think you have to have a heart of grace and being willing to accept the person no matter what. So that's important too.
So you had talked a little bit about just, psychology, and that you are also interested in theology. You read theology because, you know, for some of those same reasons, because it's getting at the heart of the matter. So, do you mind talking a little bit about like who you read or find fascinating, or sort of what you're reading right now? Something like that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think some of it, maybe I use theology in a little bit of a looser term. So,
this is a theology of hustle. So, you know, we're using it in a fairly loose term already. So I'm good with that.
Some of what I'm reading, you know, or have read in the past, or things I've been interested in, have to do with the integration of psychology and theology. So some of the, you know, maybe some of the more difficult issues that we struggle with in psychology or with Christianity and Christian counseling, you know, I wanted to really get to the bottom of what the Bible and what Christians think about that. So I'll give you an example. When I was in graduate school, you know, I had grown up in an evangelical, more conservative Christian environment with Campus Crusade and a lot of those formative experiences. And when I went to graduate school in psychology, one of the major points, I guess you could call it points of contention, were certain multicultural and diversity issues. So, for example, you know, the program I was in was very, very much gay affirming. And I was kind of trying to figure out what I thought about that, because I had always been taught that being gay was a sin. And so I wanted to really get to the bottom of what Christian thinkers are thinking about in regard to homosexuality. So that's where I kind of, you know, tried to find all the people who were doing work in that area, both psychologists and theologians, and what they were talking about. And so I read, you know, books that were more gay affirming and offered a gay affirming theological stance. And then I also read books that were, you know, presented the, you know, why from their standpoint, we should maintain the conservative Christian sexual ethic when it came to LGBT issues. So I read a bunch of books on that. So that's kind of an example. You know, I've been really interested lately in how we think about and read the Bible. So that's been kind of an intriguing area for me, because I think, again, in some of these issues that are really, really difficult in terms of the integration of psychology and theology, it comes back to how we read the Bible. A lot of times becomes what's really important. So, you know, people might, you know, I've heard people say, you know, I think this argument about being gay affirming and LGBT rights is, you know, I like that argument. It makes sense to me, but, you know, what about what the Bible says in these, you know, six verses? And if we offer a different interpretation of that, you know, can we really trust anything in the Bible? Can we trust that Jesus was who he said he was, and things like that? So a lot of what I've read, you know, over the past several years has to do with the Bible, how people think about the Bible. You know, right now I'm reading a book, and it's about Jesus and what scholars think about who Jesus was and what he said he was. And it's it's kind of a back and forth between N.T. Wright and Marcus Borg. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they, so they offer a back and forth on all these different aspects of Jesus. You know, how do we know about Jesus from the sources of the New Testament? Who was Jesus and what was his mission? You know, was Jesus, you know, did Jesus rise from the dead? Was Jesus born of a virgin, et cetera, et cetera. So they kind of tackle all these key questions of Jesus and offer their competing perspectives.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Marcus Borg, I think, is started the Jesus Seminar, was like a big mover in that, sort of figuring out what the like basis of the actual New Testament writings were and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I bought this book from the Jesus Seminar, and it's kind of an interesting, I mean, maybe I thought it was really interesting. It might be controversial for some, but basically they were trying to figure out, you know, which of Jesus' sayings actually go back to the historical Jesus. And so it's the Gospels. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they also throw in the Gospel of Thomas in there for good measure. And then, you know how some Bibles are red letter Bibles. So they have a red letters for the words of Jesus. So this Bible has, you know, red letters for words that they thought, hey, this definitely goes back to the historical Jesus. And then, but they also have some others. So they have, if it's in black, they say, you know, this probably isn't what Jesus said. It was probably in put later from the developing tradition. And then if it's pink, it's like, well, this is probably the words of Jesus, but we're not sure. And then if it's gray, it says, you know, this probably wasn't the words of Jesus, but Jesus, it sounds like something Jesus said. So everything that Jesus said is kind of divided into those four categories. So yeah, it's interesting to see what historical scholars actually think goes back to the historical person of Jesus.
Yeah, that is super fascinating. We did a lot of work with sort of Jesus Seminar stuff when I was in grad school. And like basically the entire Gospel of John is all like grayed out, right? I mean, there's like none of it left, you know. It's really...
Well, I never really realized that, you know, that before I started to get into it, that the picture of Jesus as presented in the Synoptic Gospels is pretty different than the picture of Jesus presented in the Gospel of John. And so I'd always thought like if there's differences, that just means that the different Gospels are, you know, presenting a different picture of Jesus, but it's all true and all able to be reconciled. But yeah, some of the historical scholars will say that the later Gospels reflect more of the developing tradition being overlaid onto the historical Jesus. So yeah, I don't really know what I think about that, but it's definitely an interesting perspective to wrestle with.
No, I love it. I love that you wrestle with that, because I didn't know that other people actually read that outside of like, you know, in schools, you know, in grad school. I love that. So what I'm hearing you say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like we're kind of going back to that integration thing from the beginning, where we have to be people who are not afraid of ideas that challenge our preconceived notions of things, right? Like you can't just sort of cover your ears in one way, like with the LGBTQ, you know, controversy or, you know, thoughts like, oh, I don't believe that, so I'm going to run away and not deal with any of that stuff, right? Because that's what we tend to want to do, I feel like.
Yeah, you know, I think, I have a few thoughts on that. You know, one, a real big touch point that I keep coming back to in my Christian faith, and then also in my academic research and journey and my integration of the two, is the idea that all truth is God's truth. Mm-hmm. And to not be afraid of certain things just because it's maybe a little bit different than what I was taught growing up. You know, one of my first real struggles with that actually came in my freshman year of college when I was at Wheaton. And at that time I had thought about maybe going pre-med. And so I was in the introduction to biology course. And one of our tasks was we read this book that talked about the creation account and creation and evolution. And it was presented three views. One was a 7-24-hour day creation view. The next was a theistic evolution view. And the third was kind of in between, that, you know, God created in these days, but actually a day was considered like an age, like a long
right day age theory. Yeah, right.
Yeah, day age theory. And so I was kind of interested in it because I had never really thought about that much before. I think I had assumed that it was 7-24-hour days because that's just kind of how it sounded in the Bible, but I'd never really thought about it or read anything on it. The chapter on the 7-24-hour days, it was really shocking because right off the bat, the authors said, you know, the scientific evidence doesn't support this view, but we feel that it's important to present this view because it is most consistent with a literal reading of the scriptures. And I struggled with that a lot because I was like, you know, what do you mean the scientific evidence doesn't support this view? Like, you're the ones who's supposed to be presenting this view. You know, you're supposed to be presenting the best evidence for this view. And right off the bat, you're saying the scientific evidence doesn't support it. And so I think I struggle with individuals and churches who kind of have that opinion. Like, we are coming to the table with a certain set of preconceived notions about the Bible, about Jesus, about human nature. And if something comes up either from our research in theology or research in historical criticism of the Bible or research in psychology, for example, that disconfirms or makes us or encourages us to rethink that view, you know, we're going to automatically dismiss it. But if we're unwilling to even consider findings from science or history or the cultural context, I think we're gonna not find the truth of what God wants for us today, and we're gonna hurt a lot of people in the process. So, I do think that integration is important.
Yeah, well, and just being like critical thinkers. I mean, it feels like when you just sort of refuse to listen to other arguments and even think through them or give them even a shot, you're diminishing what it is to use your brain, you know, and at least just wrestle, right? That's like, you don't even have to come to the same conclusions as you have or I have or whatever, but just the willingness to wrestle, I think, is something that we've lost. You know, it's we're scared. We're scared of thinking something different or being challenged, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I think certain perspectives on religion make that a more difficult process. You know, I've done some work and some research on religious humility or the lack thereof. And I think, I think people really struggle with that. Like, I think there was a great book by Greg Boyd I read, and about this issue. I'm trying to remember the name. I think it was something.
Well, we'll put it in the, I'll get you to remember. We'll put it in the show notes or whatever, right? Yeah.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah. But it was basically, his point was that many Christians equate faith and your level of faith with being certain that what you believe is true. So kind of this idea, you know, if you had the faith of, you know, if you had at least even a small amount of faith, you could kind of say this mountain go and it would move, you know, and they kind of think about faith as being really certain that what you believe is true. And that goes against the idea of we should always be thinking, always be reflecting, always be being open to new perspectives or points of view. Like, that should be actually part of our faith. It should be growing. It should be expanding. If I believe the same thing that I do now in 20 years, like, that's a problem. You know, whereas a lot of, I think, Christians and churches would say, get nervous when someone changes their mind on something or sees that as a lack of faith or kind of going off the rails, you know?
Yeah. Thank God that he wants us to change and that changes us and constantly refines us, right? Getting to the heart of who we are and changing us.
There's a great story. And this may be controversial as well. You can delete it if you want to. But one of my favorite stories of Jesus is when he's confronted by the Greek woman, and the Greek woman asks for a healing, and Jesus says that it's not right to take what's meant for the children and give it to the dogs.
Right.
And so he's saying that, you know, he's kind of saying like, my purpose here is for the people of Israel. My purpose is for the Jewish people. It's not for you, the Gentiles. And the woman responds by saying that even the dogs get to eat the scraps that fall from the master's table. And Jesus makes a shift. And you may think that, you know, Jesus can't change or learn, but he does make a shift. He says, you know, based on your faith, and he changes his mind and he does the healing. And I think, I don't know if this is how sound this is theologically, but one perspective I have is that Jesus really expanded his ministry at that time. Before, you know, maybe he was really locked in on, you know, serving and reaching the Jewish people. But you fast forward to the Great Commission, it's it's not just the Jewish people, it's all nations. And so there was this expansion of, I think, of how Jesus viewed himself and his mission. So even Jesus was open to change, I think, and open to you know, hearing from God and doing something different.
Well, you may have just like launched me onto one of my major soapboxes, but I think what you just said is hard for a lot of people to like think about. But Jesus was a man. I mean, Jesus was fully man. He was fully God. But Jesus, like, there was a time when Jesus was a tiny baby. And like Jesus learned stuff and he grew, and to diminish that, to take that away, is to diminish his humanity. And I think what you're saying is, I think, really appropriate, you know, that Jesus did learn. He learned his mission through the God, through the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures. So, yeah.
Yeah. And people struggle with seeing the humanity of Jesus. You know, there's an interesting researcher, psychologist by the name of Richard Beck, and he has a great book called Unclean, by the way, if anyone wants a great book recommendation. But he talks about in that book, some of his research that he does about how people really struggle with seeing Jesus as fully human. So he'll ask people questions, kind of weird questions to think about, right? But, you know, did Jesus ever get sick?
Yeah.
You know, did Jesus ever, you know, stub his toe? Did Jesus ever, you know, get a bloody knee? Or, you know, did Jesus ever have a nocturnal emission? And some of these things that we're kind of like, oh, you know, probably, you know, our initial reaction is like, no, like Jesus wouldn't have done any of those things. But if we do really believe that Jesus was fully human, we have to wrestle with the humanity of Jesus in some interesting ways.
We totally do. And then how do you interact? How do you love a God that would come down to earth and just like walk through it, never stubbing his toe or getting sick and never really experiencing what it is for us to be human, right? So like you diminish the relationship you can even have with Jesus when you don't view him as fully human, right?
Yeah, but people freak out about that. I mean, even think about, this is a little bit more before my time, but the negative reaction to the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, right? Where they show Jesus having a vision about what life would be like if he would have taken a different route and had a normal life and not gone to the cross, including, you know, possibly a sexual relationship. But it's like, yeah, could Jesus have even thought about that? Could he have been tempted in that way? I think it's difficult for people to wrestle with and think about.
It really is. But it opens up this whole new world of like, my God really does love me because he's willing to like walk through what I've been through. Like there's nothing that I can go through that he can't truly understand. Right. It changes everything, I think. So, okay. So I like to finish up with two questions. So first, what is the most interesting or strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I think my most interesting job was a summer in college. I lived in Ocean City, New Jersey, near the boardwalk, and I worked at Pelican Pete's Island Car Wash. So it was a hand washing place. So I was, you know, washing cars, doing, you know, whatever you do to the tires, handing out air fresheners and stuff like that all summer long.
Wow, Pelican Pete's. That sounds pretty legit, man.
Yeah, it was. It was expensive. But, you know. Yeah, next time you're in Ocean City, New Jersey, go buy a Pelican Pete's and have your car washed or detailed.
I have to remember that. That's good advice for sure. Okay, so for the final question, what advice would you give to, you know, somebody maybe thinking about going into psychology or, you know, sort of young in their job going in to be a professor? What advice would you give to somebody, as far as ministry goes?
Yeah. You know, I think, yeah, that's a good question. My initial thought was, to not be in a rush and take your time and really look for opportunities in your day-to-day life to see people and love people. And that's something that I think I've struggled with over the years and have to, you know, continually remind myself to do that, because sometimes in my job, it's probably not just my job. I bet it's, it's everyone's job, but I get so focused on my tasks for the day and so like locked into my job and my work and my writing and my meetings and that I'm just going through life at a fast clip in my work. And I don't take the time to, you know, knock on someone's door and ask them how they're doing or ask them how, if I could help them in any way or if they need anything or, cause I think those are really ways to integrate, Jesus and ministry into your day-to-day life. Even if you're not, even if you don't have a job that's explicitly focused on Christianity or ministry, but I really think that's what God calls us to do, is to love other people well. And I think there's plenty of opportunities to do that in whatever job you're at, but we just don't, we're going through too fast. We don't take the time to even like look at someone and think about what they're needing or what they're wanting or ask how I could help you or love you today in a practical way. So I would say slow down and love people up close.
Man, that's good. That's amazing advice. So sweet, sweet. Well, thanks so much. I can't say thanks enough for, you know, persisting with me through technical difficulties and all that, and just being here and being willing to share. So thanks a ton, man.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep. We will talk to you soon. Next time I'm in Dallas, I'm there. We're hanging. Okay.
Okay, great.
All right.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Josh. I know I really enjoyed this interview and just getting to talk to him. I feel like I was challenged. And if you felt challenged by anything sort of we talked about, I'd love to talk about that stuff. I'm kind of a nerd, if you haven't noticed already. And I just really enjoyed talking about theology and just our relationships with God. So if you have any questions or thoughts, let me know. But I would love to have a conversation about those things. Next week coming up, I have Ashley, who does adoption work. She's in ministry. She owns a jewelry business, and she just has some really cool stuff to talk about. So next Tuesday, Ashley will be live. Look forward to that. And yeah, let me know what you think. I love hearing from you. And if you have people that I need to be interviewing, let me know. I'll chat with them. So until next time, get out there and hustle.